It's November 6th, 1993. I'm here to interview Roy Madsen about his life in Kodiak, in particular, as it relates to the fishing industry. But first, tell me about your childhood. Where were you born and raised?
Well, I was born in a village on the Alaska Peninsula, not too far from half my national monument, called Kinetic. And lived there until I was about 3 years old. And then my family moved to Kodiak. And my mother was originally from Kodiak, so it was home to her. And I was raised here in Kodiak, went to grade school and high school in Kodiak.
And your mother's maiden name was?
Matrokin.
Matrokin. So right. Her family was here.
Yeah.
And you had cousins, and you grew up with lots of family members?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh. We had aunts and uncles and lots of cousins.
Lots of cousins. Who were your brothers and sisters?
Well, there were eight in our family. I had a brother Alf and a brother Elizabeth and Rose, Thelma Johnson, and myself, and then a sister Alice. And my mother died when Alice was an infant, about a year and a half old, and when my father remarried a lady by the name of Alexandria Chernoff, and I had a half sister and a half brother, Raymond and Jermaine, and my stepmother was related to the Hubley family. Mrs. Hubley was her sister, Mrs. Norton was her sister, Mrs. Scholl was her sister. It's quite a large family, so that kind of extended our family in other directions with that marriage, because we were all kind of considered related,
mm-hmm.
even though not by blood, by marriage, we were very close.
Uh-huh. Did you always live in the town of Kodiak, or did you ever live out in the villages?
Well, we always lived in the town, but we used to travel to hunting camps in different bays.
Okay, you'd mentioned that you sometimes went out of town to go to the bear camps?
Yes, my father was in the big game guiding business, and he had bear camps in Mush Bay and Ugani and at Harlech Lake, and we used to travel out to the bear camps in the spring for the spring hunts and also in the fall of the year.
Did you go out hunting with them, or were you did you remain mostly in camp with your mom and your sisters?
Well, my father first started taking me out when I was 11 years old, and I stayed in the camp until I was about 14 or 15, and then I started going out when I was probably about 14 or 15 years old. I used to go out on the hunts with them, actually, and I would carry extra jackets and binoculars and things like that.
Sort of the gopher.
That's right, yeah, right.
Did famous people come to the bear camp? I mean, was it a well-known thing in the States?
Well, of course, this was during the Depression, and so only people that were very wealthy could come on this kind of a hunt, because it was quite lengthy. Most of the people had to travel by train to Seattle, and then there was one ship a month to Kodiak, and so they'd travel to Kodiak and then up to our bear camp, and they would stay for 3 weeks, and so it was a long, long time, and most of the people were, like I say, well-to-do millionaires.
Mm-hmm. People could afford to come here.
Yes, that's right.
Did the Depression affect Kodiak as it may have other places? I mean,
well, definitely. There was very little money in Kodiak. There weren't any jobs. Of course, it was a fishing village of about 450 people, and so the people that still were fishing, but the prices were so low that nobody had any money, and they had to grow vegetables like potatoes and carrots and mm-hmm. turnips in their gardens, and just buy staples like flour and tea and sugar and coffee from the store.
So people lived a subsistence lifestyle?
Right. They shot ducks and put up a lot of salt fish and ate a lot of clams. Nobody went hungry, but it was a pretty monotonous diet, lots of beans and things like that.
Before the Depression, you would have been really young, but do you remember the 20s being an economically boom time for Kodiak? Was fishing very important? Was it commercial fishing important to the community as it is today?
Well, of course, Kodiak was always a fishing community, and we had a cannery here in town where King Crab is now, and everybody in town fished. That was the only industry that we had here other than the school, and business was good as far as the hunting business was concerned up until 1929 when the stock crash happened. And then it became a little bit leaner after that.
How did World War II change Kodiak?
Well, of course, Kodiak started to change before World War II happened because the United States started to build up its defenses in the late 30s, and they came to Kodiak about 1939 and looked the place over and decided that it was a good location for a naval base. And so they started to build the what's now the Coast Guard base about 1940, and so there's a lot of construction going on here and doubled the size of the community immediately. With construction workers, and I graduated from high school in 1941, and I worked out on the base. I worked on a tugboat that summer, and then in the fall I left home and went down to Oregon to go to college. So I wasn't here during the war years. I left in August of 1941, and I didn't come back until January of 1946, after the war was over.
Oh, did your father continue his bear camps through those years?
No, there wasn't any hunting during the war years. There was no travel. Travel was restricted. In fact, it was restricted to wartime supplies and things like that. And so the Army and Navy pretty much took over everything. On the island and built defenses around there. And my dad had, before the war started, he had made our house into a hotel because it had originally been built as a three-story log house, and he had a general merchandise store in the downstairs. And then when he went into the guiding business, he closed the store down and used it to store all of his tents and stoves and canoes and things like that that he used in his hunting business. And when the only hotel in Kodiak burned down, there wasn't a hotel, so he remodeled the downstairs and made rooms and made it into a hotel. And then when the construction started on the Navy base, he branched out into the curio business. He had a little store, and he'd spent a number of years up in the Arctic, and so he had good contacts, and he could buy mufflucks and parkas and all kinds of ivory and things like that. And he used his contacts there to keep supplies and sell souvenirs. And so he did that during the war years.
Is that the home that's across from catty corner from Cherry and King building, the house that Markham lives in, or is that?
Oh, no, that house, the house that was that I grew up in was in the urban renewal district, and it was torn down. It was quite large, and but it's right at the corner across from Kodiak Motors, where the chiropractor's doctor.
Oh, yeah, in the bottom of Cherry and King.
Right, that it would be right there on that corner.
Well, during the war, you say you were able to go down to Oregon to go to school. How did you travel to get down there if it was restricted?
Well, this was before the war.
Oh, you went.
I left here in August of 1941. Went down to Oregon on a ship, Alaska steamship.
That was the only way to get out of Kodiak then?
Yes. I didn't have any aircraft in those days. I did go down the year before. I went down in 1940 and I worked on a cannery tender over in Uganic for the summer. And at the end of the season, I went south on the boat that I worked on. It was a 50-foot boat that I used to pick up fish and from gill netters around the island. And so I went south. That was my first trip out of Alaska.
It was your first trip?
When I was 17.
Oh. So you didn't get on the steamer often, and as we do today, get on the ferry and go for a trip. It wasn't that common.
No, nobody ever did that. No, it was too costly. And
people in the days when you say you were working on a tender, the most of the fish was canned, or was it salted?
No, it was all canned.
It was all canned?
Right.
And here in Kodiak, or did they take it down?
No, actually, when I worked on the tender, I worked at for an outfit called San Juan Fishing and Packing Company in Uganic.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two canneries in Uganic. There was one in Larson Bay, and one in Alatak, one in Kodiak.
And did they process it here, or they process it out in the bay? They can it out the canneries out there.
Right. Yeah.
Were the villages in those days much bigger than they are today, like Akiak and Karlik?
Yes, they were. They were quite a bit larger.
And they had a.
Well, I'd say Old Harbor wasn't as large as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Pogneck was quite a large village. In fact, they had three stores in Pogneck. We only had two in Kodiak, but Pogneck had three stores. So it was quite a bustling community.
So the canneries helped keep the villages going by having, or was it just that there were more people that lived there then?
Well, the people that lived there, they were industrious. They were all fishermen or worked for the canneries.
Mm-hmm. Well, you yourself went fishing when you returned to Kodiak after the war?
Yes, I did.
And where did you fish?
I fished up in Bristol Bay.
For salmon?
For salmon.
And what was that fishery like?
Well, I guess in order to put the story in context, I should tell you that, you know, during the time that I was growing up, every son wanted to emulate his father.
Mm-hmm.
And my father had been born in Denmark and left home when he was 14 years old. He was a sailor on a square rigger, so he was a sailing ship sailor. Very tough life, and he used to tell stories about sailing around Cape Horn and how tough it was and climbing up in the rigging and things like that. And in growing up in Kodiak, as I told you earlier, it was a very, very small town, and everybody was involved in the fishery locally here. Seining for salmon or gill netting, but there were a few people that used to travel to Bristol Bay to fish up there, and they were kind of set apart from the rest of the community. I think they had a little bit of a mystique about them because they made a lot of money in a very short period of time, and up there they still use sailboats. That's all. They didn't allow any power, and so they were just different than the rest of the fishermen in our community.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, they'd come back with stories about the people that they fished up in the bay, the people, I guess Corsicans, and people from Sicilians, and a lot of Finns from Astoria.
People from San Francisco.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And I recall these men would leave Kodiak and go up to Bristol Bay on the ship that used to stop in Kodiak, and when they'd come back, there would be a lot of excitement in the community, you know, knowing that the Bristol Bay fishermen had come back and they were loaded with money.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I different things that piqued your interest, I saw one fellow come back one year wearing a pair of leather hip boots. And this was not uncommon. I mean, this was the outfit that the Finnish fishermen
were.
Their leather, their hip boots were made out of leather instead of rubber.
Wow.
And you know, things, it was just different.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, my father had been in the Navy, and so I felt like I had to go in the Navy, and I spent I enlisted in the Navy and spent 4 years there during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Then I came back, and I guess I was trying to prove to him that I could be as tough as he was. So instead of fishing locally here, I had an uncle that lived up in Bristol Bay, and I wrote to him and asked him if he could find me a job on one of the boats up there.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. So I went up to Bristol Bay to fish on a sailboat.
Wow.
Instead of using power, and that's how I got involved in fishery.
Did you do it several years in a row, or
well, this was in 1948, I think it was my first year up there.
Mm-hmm.
And the fellow that I was fishing with was a man in his 70s. He was an Estonian, and he had a master's license in sail and steam, so he was an excellent sailor. But he was also a heavy drinker, and so he had a hard time finding partners. And that's how come I was able to get on board with him. And he never left the cannery without a fifth under his arm. And we'd sail out in any kind of weather. When many times I recall when it would be blowing like mad there, and my partner would come and say, "Come on, Roy, we're going out," and we'd get on the boat, and my uncle would be standing on the dock and saying, "Don't go out with that damn fool, you're going to get drowned." Nobody else would be going out except us, but we would reef the sail down real, so there was hardly any, just enough to keep us moving, and we'd sail out there. And this boat was 32 feet long, and we lived on it, you know, when we were away from the cannery. It didn't have a cabin on it.
I was going to say, they're like open
skiffs, they're open
skiffs,
boats,
aren't
right?
They?
But we'd put the mast down, and we'd put the sail over the mast, and slept in our clothes.
Like
and,
a little tent,
right,
sort of?
And made a tent out of it, and we cooked on a Swede stove,
mm-hmm.
ate nothing but canned food.
How did you fish? Did you fish with nets or
patrol? With gill nets.
With gill nets.
Yeah, drift gill nets. You'd put up, we had three shackles of gear, about 900 feet of nets, and we'd put those things up and then let the tide carry us out to sea.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd pull them in and take the fish out and put them back out again and drift back in with the tide. And then we'd go up, and they had scows that were anchored out in the bay, and we'd sail up to one of the scows and unload our fish.
You showed me a picture of a whole line of sailboats being towed back. Why were they being towed back to shore?
Well, about twice a week they'd have closures, and so during the closures, instead of staying out there in these boats that didn't have any accommodations, mm-hmm. We had little tugboats that would tow us into the cannery, and we could take a shower and eat at the cannery,
mm-hmm.
instead of eating out of cans. And so.
What was the most scariest experience you had with this crazy drunk 70-year-old fisherman that you went out with?
Well, believe it or not, we used to do a lot of night fishing. We'd put our nets out and we'd drift and drift and drift, and on this particular occasion, we drifted all night, and when I get up in the morning, I couldn't see any land. Of course,
uh-oh.
It's very flat out there, and there was no wind, so we couldn't sail. And like I told you, the boat was 32 feet long. We had two pair of 14-foot oars, and you had to put a board across with a board ship,
mm-hmm.
and stand up on the thing and row. And I rowed that boat all day long, and I don't think hardly made any progress at all, but there wasn't any wind, and we were...
You were drifting out in the middle of the Bering Sea, weren't you?
Yeah.
You were out of the bay by then, weren't you?
But finally, some wind came up, and we started to sail, and then pretty soon we could see the land, and we sailed back in.
How many years did you go fishing out there?
Well, I just fished 2 years. The first year that I fished up there, we had a terrible, terrible storm, and 14 of the fishermen were drowned, which was a terrific amount. They'd get their boats loaded, and the boats would swamp, and of course the water's very silty, and if you dressed so warm, you had to... Well, what I wore was heavy wool underwear, a wool shirt, wool pants, and then I wore a sheepskin coat over my wool shirt, hip boots, and oilskins on top of that.
Wow.
And we didn't have any life jackets on the boats, and so if you fell in, you just went right to the bottom. Your clothes would fill up with sand, and a lot of times at night, we didn't have any lights on the boats, and a power boat would come down, crash right into one, and turn it over, cut it in two, or something like that. So there's a lot of boats that were lost. Or they'd go aground on a sandbar.
Mm-hmm.
It's very shallow up there, like Cook Inlet, and it's muddy. When you went ashore, you couldn't get out, and you just had to wait for the tide to come in. It's very strong and heavy tides. And so there was a lot of men lost, and I questioned my sanity the first year, but I went back for a second year.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the fishing finished for the summer, I decided I wasn't going to fish anymore, and decided to leave Alaska and go back to school.
What kind of prices or crew shares did you get in those days? I mean, I know the economy was different, but...
Well, we got paid 25 cents for a red salmon.
Per pound or
no,
per fish?
Per fish.
Wow.
And 75 cents for a king salmon.
And any other species caught besides reds
and
kings?
No, just reds and kings.
Up there?
Right.
And
I think that the most I ever made, and I used to go up there before the fishing season started, and I would work when the ships would come in with the supplies for the cannery. I would longshore.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would stay after the season was over and longshore, loading all the canned salmon onto the ships and cleaning up the boats at the end of the season and everything like that, because my uncle was the head of a beach gang. And I think the most I made was $2,300. Working June, July, and August, about 3 months.
When you came back to Kodiak in those years, and before you went to Oregon to go to school, did you find a work in Kodiak?
Oh, yes. I used a longshore here, too. I did that during the summer months, and then in the winter time, I worked in Kraft's Men's Store.
Oh.
And so I worked the year round. Then I guided in the spring and fall with my father.
So your father still had his...
Yes. I got a guide's license, and I used to go out with him. I'd go out around the 1st of April and guide until June, and then I'd go to Bristol Bay, fish until August, and then I'd longshore until September, and go back out guiding from September to November, and I worked in Kraft's Men's Store from November till April.
Well, you were supporting a family then.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
you had Aliza and Mary Jane born by this time?
Yeah.
So in those early days, was king crab ever caught?
No. No.
There was no inkling of...
Well, believe it or not, I first saw a king crab when I was about 6 or 7 years old. One of our neighbors brought a king crab over to our house and gave it to us, and I remember we had it in a room in a washtub, and that thing was sitting there with the legs hanging over the edge of the washtub, and that was the first and only king crab that I saw until I came back here in 1961. They must have been here. but I never saw it.
It wasn't a part of a native diet. I mean,
no,
it was probably too hard to catch, maybe, or
no.
The last question I was going to ask you this evening, I think, was fisheries has always been important to Kodiak, and your father's bear. Oh no, I was going to ask you. Change that question. Never mind. Oh, did your father's bear guiding business have a peak? I mean, was there a time when it was really having a booming day? For example, after the war, did he have a real successful the guiding business? Did it reach success and continue on until his death, or did it fall off after a certain number of years?
After World War II, when he took up guiding again, I think it was in 1946, it was very successful up until the time he died in 1954. He had, the hunts were 2 weeks then, he had his own boat, he used to take the parties on his own boat, and his boats got successively larger. So he had a 42-foot boat, then he had a 65-foot boat, then he had a 96-foot boat. So
he was real successful.
Yes.
Some more about your fishing experiences.
Fished up in Bristol Bay in 1948-1949, just after I left the fishery, they passed a law that permitted them to use power. And so in 1950, I think it was a year after I left, or 1951, they started to put power in the boats. And
what was the reason for not letting them use?
Here's a picture. It's conservation.
Oh.
Because the water is real muddy, it is in Cook Inlet, and silty,
shallow.
And if they permitted power, they were afraid that the boats would just wipe out the fishery. And of course, you've probably read about the record fishery they've had the last couple of years, so they managed to sustain their yield very well. It's a very valuable fishery still. But the first attempt at power, they put a outboard on one of those sailboats, and that didn't work very well. The outboard motor was added without success, and so then they start building little boats specifically for Bristol Bay, and then bring them up on a big ship.
Would the ship be the tender eventually, or the?
No, that was a freighter that it would bring the supplies up and then take the pack back down in the fall, because they didn't have any place to store the boats. The canneries had their own place there, but these were brand new, and so they were built in Seattle. And the original boats that I fished in were called Columbia River boats, because they originated on the Columbia River. That's the kind of boats that they fished in on the Columbia River here in the 30s.
They're mostly double enders and
double enders, right.
Both ends are pointed.
Right.
And so did the power, adding power to the fishery, did it make for smaller catches because there were more boats, or they were faster and they filled? Did they have quotas in those days? Oh, that's too
no, far. They didn't have quotas. Just whatever the cannery could process is what they allowed them to catch, and I can't recall ever the canneries being so full up that they wouldn't take fish.
And so did the fishery change much with the advent of power?
Oh, very much. It has changed tremendously, because the original boats were just modifications of the little 32 footers, and now they're built so that, in fact, some of the boats are built that they're larger than 32 feet, but they can take the bow off of them, a detachable bow, and they're very, very wide, so that they've got all kinds of room, and they have power rollers. Like when I was fishing, you pulled the net over the stern roller by hand. Now they have power rollers that. And they have big drums that the nets go on, so they just haul them up like that. Everything's by power nowadays, and it's much easier.
That's probably what Bristol Bay still is, a lucrative fishing ground.
Very.
The permits out there are probably very expensive, worth a lot.
Oh, yes. I think the last that I heard, something like $250,000 for a permit.
Wow. That's a lot. That could be somebody's whole season.
That's right. The boats are probably, the modern boats probably sell for around $250,000. They have all kinds of electronic gear on them, and they're very comfortable quarters that can live right on them.
During that time here in Kodiak, did they have a seine fishery?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And has that always been in existence since they've had power boats?
Yes. They had little seiners. You know, they when I was a kid, the seiners were probably about 32, 34 feet long. And as things have progressed, they have what they call the limit is
right.
58 foot. So they have 58 foot. A lot of the boats are 58 foot limit seiners. And they're worth $750,000.
Right now.
Right. And they have big power skips too.
Right.
And their nets are much bigger because they seine off of the capes around the island. And